So beginning this hour, we're going to be discussing phobias. Do we all have them? I'm assuming we all have them. But my next guest will give me all the answers that I possibly can question him with in the next few minutes, I hope. And that is Professor Brendan Kelly. He is, of course, the Professor of Psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
I'm probably putting a bit of weight in your shoulders there, am I, asking that first question. Do we all humans, do we have phobias?
We all have anxieties that are irrational to certain points, to certain degrees. I guess they become phobias when they're very focused on one thing and when they start to cause us problems. They start to, you know, be disabling. So many people won't walk under a ladder. That's partly superstition. It's partly anxiety. But then if you started avoiding all ladders as a result of that, and this led to problems in your life, it could become a phobia, something that you avoid, even though maybe you need to have something to do with them, or even though the avoidance causes you problems from day to day.
Okay, so if one was to think about phobias, would say agoraphobia, that is the fear of open spaces. Is that the correct definition there? Outside spaces, is that how you'd word that?
Well, it's really, agoraphobia is a very interesting one, because the fear tends to be in public spaces, crowds, public places, maybe travelling away from home, travelling alone. And in these, with agoraphobia, in these situations, the person feels overwhelming anxiety and a need to exit the situation. So the classic example is in the supermarket with a trolley full of food and things. The person is overwhelmed by anxiety and has to abandon the trolley, run out, go back and sit in their car in the car park until the thumping heart calms down and they feel less anxious. And that's agoraphobia.
So on the lines, I guess, of some sort of panic that person is experiencing, maybe potentially an anxiety or panic attack. But with agoraphobia, Brendan, how does it form? You mentioned it's, you know, public spaces. It can also be outdoor spaces. It could be, you know, certain public spaces like a supermarket or driving by oneself. It just kind of, to a lot of people, feel like it just happens one day.
It tends to build up over time. And, you know, so much of what we do is determined by habit. So a little habit, such as avoiding something or being a little bit anxious, can become embedded and can grow over time and lead to a pattern of avoidance. But sometimes it's so slow that we don't even notice it happening. We might notice it in ourselves or in other people until it reaches a certain point of severity. But the reason it's so difficult is oftentimes when the person is being overwhelmed by the panic or the anxiety, there is a little logical bit of their brain that is telling them, this is too much, this is disproportionate, this is not logical. And yet, despite that little logical voice, the waves of anxiety still come and the person feels they can only address them by leaving the situation abruptly or running away or going home where they are safe. Although if you ask safe from what they really are safe from is anxiety rather than a real threat.
How does a phobia affect one human so badly compared to another that is not affected by something at all? You know, to a lot of people, you know, hearing the fact that you can't drive a certain distance by yourself or you can't go to a public space would make them scratch their head and not understand it. Why does it happen to some people? Is it something to do with our genes?
Well, there is a genetic element to it. If phobias run in the family, then you're more likely to get them. But overall, you know, the chances are you won't get it. So there's a small genetic component. Sometimes it's linked to events in the environment, a negative experience in a similar situation or at a similar time that somehow kicks in. But sometimes it's not very logical. Sometimes, you know, you will really struggle to find a reason. And often people feel that if they could get to the very kernel of why this started in the beginning, that they could address it. But sometimes you can't figure that out and you simply need to deal with the problem as it is today and as it affects you, rather than necessarily focusing on digging deep and looking for a cause, which quite frankly might not exist.
Okay, because I started with, you know, a phobia like agoraphobia, because obviously this can really damage people's lives. They can't do certain things. They can't live the lifestyle they want, do the things they want to do in life. And a lot of other, you know, phobias attached to that and anxieties, of course. But I said that first because with say a phobia like spiders, arachnophobia, that is thrown around a lot. It is still technically a phobia. I am somebody who is very much afraid of spiders. I, in recent years, have started to catch them myself in a glass. That's about as far as I can go in like a pint glass. But previously, I would completely freeze and not be able to move. Now, my mother's convinced it was because I had a babysitter when I was younger. And she was scared of spiders and I just also became scared of spiders. How come it is one day that I was completely frozen in fear by these things and now I can, I guess, push myself to catch them in a glass? Not that that makes me very brave or anything.
Well, it does make you very brave, but there are some things that it appears we are programmed to be more likely to become phobic about. So you have some ones that are understandable, maybe like, claustrophobia, fear of closed spaces. I guess there's some reason for that, although it becomes disproportionate in some people. And then spiders are something that come up in every culture around the world as common objects of phobia, even in countries where spiders aren't terribly harmful at all and are very, very tiny. You meet people who are anxious, really disproportionately anxious. It's something to do with their size and their shape and the way they move, I think, just seems to appeal to something or indeed, you know, make us anxious on the basis of some very old, ancient thing in our genes. But what you're doing is a form of graded exposure, which is basically the treatment for many phobias, which is psychological treatment, whereby, you know, if it's causing a problem in the person's life, they have a gradual exposure to the stimulus. And if we go back to the agoraphobia and someone leaving the supermarket, they might end up avoiding the supermarket entirely, but a program of treatment for them would involve them maybe driving to the car park of the supermarket, sitting in the car for 5 minutes and then driving home again and seeing they can do that. And then maybe the following week, stepping out of the car in the car park of the supermarket for 5 minutes and just going home afterwards and proving they can do that. So a very gradual exposure. So with the spider, you might, maybe now you don't shriek and leave the room. You can trap it under a glass. Maybe in time you'll slip a piece of paper under the glass and carry the spider outside.
I have done that.
Well done. Well, great.
Thank you very much.
Next time, perhaps you'll hold a spider in your hand.
No.
And eventually we'll reach a position where you've got
I'm okay.
Spiders in.
No, I don't want to get that good at it. Like, I'm okay with having the fear to a degree. But Sylvia's been in touch, Brendan, 0833 97 97 97. She says her fear is spiders. You know, big surprise there. And ladders. And also the number 9. It's so interesting the way you say it. Obviously, you would know this as a professor of psychiatry, but we always try to understand things and get to the root of things, as you said. One can kind of understand why you could be agoraphobic, anxious about a certain thing if you'd had a bad experience, spiders. But how is it that a lot of people are afraid of certain numbers?
Yeah, no, that's terribly interesting, and it's usually the same numbers. It's very rare you meet someone who's scared of the number 4, for example. It seems to be a friendly number somehow.
Yeah, I like 4. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, 4 is a nice one. But 9, people do get scared of 9. Odd numbers a little bit more than even numbers, and rarely numbers above 10. This doesn't make hardly any sense at all. And anyone who looks for meaning in why they're scared of a particular number, they're really making up meaning, and that's not a bad thing. We make up stories so that the world makes sense to us. But in point of fact, being scared of a specific number is probably something quite random that will resist any explanation. But that's not to stop people creating a story around it in order to try and accept it more.
Yeah, well, Sylvia has actually got back in touch and she says some people obviously don't like the number 13. I think we've all heard of that one. But she says for her it's 9 because she has this thing about numbers of 9. They brought bad luck with her family. So you can understand, I guess. She says, I will always check the car reg as well. My granny doesn't like the number 11. And she got one year she got a brand new car in 2011 and it was like 11 LD 11. She really wasn't happy with it. But she still drove it around and it did her very well. The fear of something, a phobia, why is it so difficult for other people to understand?
That's really, really interesting. The difficulty is because it's excessive and it leads to avoidance. So if you take your grandmother and the number 11, It's only a phobia if it leads her to avoid the number 11. And, you know, it's not possible to avoid the number 11. So very often people don't develop a full phobia because they literally can't. It's the same people. No one gets a phobia of fluids or food to the point where they can't eat or drink and then they die. So avoidance is a necessary part of it. And this is what makes it difficult for other people to understand. All they see is the avoidance. All they see is that the person doesn't go to the supermarket or runs from the room when there's a spider. They don't feel the anxiety that the person feels. They don't feel the terror, the fear, the pulse racing, the sweating, the heart beating. And maybe if we could really experience other people's feelings, how they feel in their bodies, we would be more empathic and more understanding about what they're going through. However illogical it might be, it is very, very real when it's happening.
Yeah, and the reason we're talking about this today, it's because trypophobia, that's a fear of small clustered holes like on a sponge or a shower head, has topped a survey from Psychic World. That's the biggest irrational fear among Irish people, ahead of the likes of open spaces, which I'm assuming they mean agoraphobia there, and spiders, arachnophobia, obviously. Trypophobia, is there a particular reason why you think Irish people, that's the top of their list?
Well, trypophobia, or the fear of holes and clusters of holes and that, it came up in the research from Psychic World. And I should add, we don't generally base our clinical practice on research from Psychic World. But in this case, that what they did was they looked at the phobias most commonly searched for on Google. So it's not necessarily the most common in the population. It is the most commonly searched for on Google in Ireland, which is, if you like, a different issue and a not uninteresting one about why people look this up, when in fact it is a very, very rare phobia, if at all. And yet it has a hold on the imagination. I guess the fact people keep looking it up speaks to the irrationality of the human mind, which is something we struggle to accept every day.
Before you go, you mightn't want to divulge this information, but do you, as a professor of psychiatry at one of the biggest universities in this country, have a phobia?
Well, I don't have a phobia that leads to any kind of disability or difficulty in my life. And people with phobias like agoraphobia and social phobia, they really have problems with them, but they are treatable and it is important to talk to your GP. I do have some small eccentricities, Kira, but you know what? If I started listing the ways in which I'm eccentric and slightly odd, this would dominate the entire next hour of your show.
Okay. I feel like that might be true. Thank you very much for letting me know that, though, Brendan. The spider thing, obviously some other people saying mice is a big fear of theirs, rats, bats. Personally, my fear, I have a long list of I don't know if I'd say phobias, Brendan. Spiders I don't like, rats I don't like, cats I don't like, bats. And I think it's all because they like run really quick and you don't know what they're going to do at any given moment. Do you know what I mean?
I do, but it's interesting how you pick those. A lot of humans run really quick and you don't know what they're going to do at any moment. And yet, you're not phobic, I imagine, about people. So it's very odd how we focus on size is important as well. We tend to be more phobic about small things than we are about large things, which again speaks to the irrationality of how we perceive risk and how we experience anxiety.
That's so true. I wouldn't be in a zoo worried about like an elephant. It makes no sense. And don't try and make sense, really, is your message probably here this afternoon. Of course, there's people out there who really, really suffer when it does come to their phobias and, you know, tied with anxieties. And of course, as Brendan said, there's always help out there and we want people to get that help. The lines such as the Samaritans, that's 116 123. The Mental Health Support Text Service is 50808. And of course, always get in touch with your GP or a medical professional if you can, and if you have any worries or if your life is being impacted, because it's just incredibly, incredibly difficult for people whose lives are impacted by their phobias. We're taking it a bit on a lighter side of things there this afternoon, but of course it can be very impactful on people's lives. Thank you so much for letting me know all about that this afternoon, Professor Brendan Kelly, of course, Professor of Psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin. Take care.
Thank you.
I don't know if you've seen these images online, but firefighters had to rescue a man after he became trapped in his home in South Dublin because of hoarding. I'm looking at some of the images online currently, and it's literally the front door and the firefighters have broken it in half. and the amount of items, I guess is all you can call them, in this person's hallway is so high that it is probably, I want to say, about 6 foot in height, but it's also then going up the stairs onto, from the hall up the stairs. It's quite incredible to see. If you go on the HSE's website, they define hoarding disorder as where a person gathers an excessive number of items and stores them. This is usually in a chaotic manner and results in unmanageable amounts of clutter. They say that hoarding can be a significant problem if the amount of clutter interferes with everyday living. It's causing distress or affecting the quality of life of the person or their family. The Dublin Fire Brigade tweeted these pictures. The piles of rubbish and belongings is how they worded it, some as high as the ceiling. This man was or is in his 70s. He was trapped, though, in his house for 14 hours. He was then taken to hospital with back injuries. That's according to the Irish Times. The fire brigade says, apart from an obvious fire and escape risk, hoarding is a health risk and a disorder that needs treatment and managing. And obviously, we were just speaking with Professor of Psychiatry, Brendan Kelly, there of Trinity College Dublin. But the chief executive of Alone does join me now, because this person, obviously a pensioner who had this situation in their home. Sean Moynihan, hi to you.
Hi, good afternoon.
So, did you feel a need at the charity? Oh, I'm sure you did. The answer probably is yes, you did feel a need at the charity to speak about this, because the person who it was affecting was in their 70s. Is there any sort of connection there with, as we get older, I guess, becoming a bit more sentimental and wanting to keep things?
No, I think the first thing that people realise is, right, I'll tell you, this isn't as uncommon as people might think, right? We would take referrals every couple of days around this, to an extent that we have an internal training and procedures for dealing with this. This is a condition and a syndrome, right, where people have really invested a whole lot of emotion into the things that they collect or the things that they hoard. So it's not necessarily linked to age. It's more linked to the condition. Naturally, because people are older, they may have been collecting and hoarding for longer. So ultimately is you might get more extreme cases.
Now, you have said previously that you see cases of hoarding about 2 to 3 times a week with the charity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, as I said, they come to light sometimes when somebody goes into hospital. Somebody, maybe the facade of the house is fine, or maybe because there's an issue, or they approach their GP, or neighbours or friends, and it comes to light. And ultimately is we have to work with the person. The main thing here is if there's a person listening around this, to take advice from somebody like ourselves or from their own GP or primary healthcare, because again, just to do a clear out of somebody's house, no matter how well-meaning, and just clear it out, might actually put an awful lot of stress and anxiety on the individual who's been hoarding, because again, it is more a condition, and it's more in the psychology and the mental health, which, you know, your previous contributor might be more qualified to define.
Yes, of course. And just to define that a little bit, a counselling psychologist and a lecturer at Technological University Dublin, her name is Leslie Shoemaker. She says hoarding is part of the OCD spectrum. So that's obsessive compulsive disorder. And it affects about 3 to 6% of the population. In conversations with the 2 to 3 cases a week that the charity would face, I guess, what are the, or are there ever reasons given as to why they may feel that they need to hoard?
No, I mean, it's within the emotions, it's within the challenges. As you say, it's on a spectrum, whether it's OCTs and others, and people develop this emotional attachment towards their goods and that. What we have experienced is, you know, in the past with people maybe who've had all the clear out done and they haven't been ready, and people trying to do it for them, but ultimately is that actually causing them huge distress. So the reality is, when we're working with people there, it's about trust, it's about relationships, it's about process, but it's also about working with specialists like counsellors or mental health, and defining what is the support, emotional support, that person needs that allow them deal with this in such a way that it won't actually happen again.
And it's totally understandable how people would get distressed if it was somebody else coming in, I guess, to go through their things, especially if they've kept them for such a long time for sentimental value or not. But of course, like we were speaking with Professor Brendan Kelly, the advice is to get in touch with your GP. If you feel like this is affecting you or someone you love, get in touch with their GP, try to converse with them. If anybody needs to speak with Alone, the charity, of course, Sean and his team have the National Support and Referral Line for Older People. That line is 0818 222 024, 0818 222 024. That is the Alone's website. And also, of course, you can get in contact with lots of mental health support services such as Aware and the Samaritans. If we go through that number again for the Samaritans, 116 123, Aware 1800 80 48 48. And there's also a mental health support text service, that's 50808. And just some stats on this. A study by Nest in the past, they reveal that almost two-fifths, that's 38% of Irish adults, consider themselves to be a hoarder. So that's obviously what you consider yourself to be is not true, because there could not be 38% when it only affects 3 to 6% of the population. I think we can be a bit flippant with our words. Well over half of respondents found it difficult, that was 58%, to get rid of possessions. I think most people do find it difficult to get rid of possessions. I'd like to hear from you if there's something in your life that you found really difficult to get rid of. I have to say, myself, I'm definitely someone who likes to keep things, you know, clean all the time. I like to throw out things all the time. I don't like to keep things for a long time. I have like a memory box and stuff like that. Always a good idea to keep one of those. But let me know what you do. The text or WhatsApp line is 0833 97 97 97. Now, early years professionals have secured their first pay deal, setting minimum wages in the sector. And to discuss this, I'm joined by the head of organising at SIP2. That is Dara O'Connor. Hello to you, Dara.
Hi, great to be on.
Well, thank you for joining me. It's the first time members working in the early childhood care and education have gotten the establishment of this employment regulation order that's setting out the minimum pay rates for the sector. First question, can you go through some of these in terms of the actual amounts people will be earning?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you probably know, and a lot of your listeners might know, that people working in early years are very low paid. So an early years educator, you know, who's qualified with a your level 5 qualification would earn €11.57 per hour, which is way below the living wage. So from now on, an educator, which is the entry grade, will earn at least €13 an hour. And then it goes up from there. So a room leader or a graduate room leader would earn €15.50, and all the way up to a graduate manager who would earn at least €17.25. So there's thousands of mostly women workers who are going to benefit from this and see kind of a, you know, an increase in their pay, and really kind of it's the start of recognising the work and the dedication and kind of valuing the care and education that they do.
Now, the Living Wage Technical Group, so they came up with the living wage rate in Ireland, €12.90 per hour. Now, I do believe that was in for the year 2021 to 2022. So before there was the invasion of Ukraine. So I'm sure the living wage in this country, I can probably bet on it, is a lot, needs to be a lot more than that. But in saying that, the early years educator starting on €13 is obviously a great foot forward.
Yeah, it is, but I think it's important to know that, like, this, it's just the first pay deal. It's certainly not the last. And we have, you know, it's mostly women who've gone out, they've got their qualifications. Some of them have got their degrees or their QQI qualifications. And it's really about kind of recognising that and giving people the opportunity to stay in their career. Because what's happening is that we have these very able, very capable people who have qualifications, and they simply can't afford to stay in the profession that they love. So they're looking down the road and say, well, I could be an SNA, or I could retrain as a primary school teacher, or I could work in Lidl and Aldi and get a higher rate of pay. And so that's why there's a staffing crisis in the sector at the moment. So this pay deal, this first pay deal, is the first step to addressing that, and giving people a reason to stay in the sector, giving them, you know, the financial incentive that they need and some kind of recognition and reward. So the intention would be, great, we get the 13 or 14 or 15, 15 euros an hour this year, and then year after year we're able to build on that and increase that until we get to, you know, a decent rate of pay for people.
Yeah, so this will come into effect from next Thursday, so just a little over a week, the 15th of September. And as you noted at the beginning of the interview, 98% of those in the profession are female, and they have done an absolute awful lot over the past 2.5 years. I hate to go back to, you know, the horrible days mid or beginning of the pandemic, but they would have been people that at points put their lives at risk, you know, caring for other people's children, so I guess we could still function as a society.
Yeah, I think there was a shift in attitude, I think, during the pandemic, where, you know, where people might have before seen it as childminding or just looking after a couple of kids, all of a sudden they realised that childcare is a vital public service, and the country kind of falls apart if they're not doing their job. And it was very difficult for people when almost everybody else was at home cocooning. Early years educators had to go to work because they were looking after the children of nurses and of doctors and people working in transport, you know, when we're down to the bare essentials of what needed to be done in the country. And they were those frontline heroes. They were essential workers as well. And I think there was a big kind of shift in the attitude towards it. And, I mean, that's incredibly impressive. And it's incredibly impressive what are these early years professionals and educators have achieved in their campaign as well. They've been out, you know, advocating, protesting, lobbying, and really kind of building a voice that couldn't be ignored by government. And, you know, fair dues to Roderick O'Gorman and the government today. They've heard what early educators had to say, and they've put their money where their mouth is and put the money on the table which is needed to support this pay deal.
Okay, well, I appreciate you going through that with us this afternoon. That is Dara O'Connor, the head of organising at SIPTU, the early years professionals. They did secure their first pay deal, setting minimum wages in the sector beginning at €13 and increasing, and they will come into effect, those pay increases, from next Thursday, just over a week away, the 15th of September. Thank you, Dara, for the time. Now, I saw this article online, All You Need to Know About Employment Contracts, and I just thought it was quite an interesting time to discuss something like this, because we're hearing so much about the winter, how we're going to cope with electricity, potential blackouts, you know, all the rest. We know, we've heard it all. And one of the things they're speaking about is, you know, public places or public service workplaces, I should say. In France and Germany, they're going to be working to a certain degree and no further or no increase from that degree. I think it's around, is it 18 or 19 in France and Germany? I believe I'd have to double check that they have decided on. So there's lots of things, I guess, people will be questioning in terms of their contract over the next few months. And Dr. Brenda Daly has written an article. She's Associate Professor of Law in the School of Law and Government at DCU. She joins me now. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Daly. Oh, unfortunately, I cannot hear you currently. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you, Kira.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
How are you? Yes, I can. Sorry about that. How are you today?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
I am good, I'm good. So you kind of heard the intro there. You know, people are questioning their contracts at the moment because things have changed a lot over the past 2.5 years, and then what's going to happen this winter. So if we go through some of the basics, Brenda, one's permanent contract, fixed term contract, what else do you have? Indefinite duration, is that how you'd word part-time contracts?
Go through
the kind of differences there for us.
I suppose there's different types of contracts. So you might have, an employer might want to hire someone for a certain period of time. So if you think within maybe the hospitality sector or retail sector, we're coming up to Christmas, different businesses might want to hire staff to cover a short period of time, the Christmas period of time. So you might have a fixed term contract for that type of work, or it might be used for maybe a research project where funding has been given for 1 year or 2 year, or maybe a fixed term contract would be used to cover things like maternity leave or if someone's out on longer term sick leave. So it's for a definite period of time. So it might be a month, 2 months, it could be a longer period of time. A permanent contract isn't sort of a job for life. A permanent contract can come to an end. Sort of, it can be by mutual agreement. You know, maybe the employee decides they want to move elsewhere. Maybe they've reached retirement age, or maybe it's because the business is in financial difficulties. They have to restructure. Maybe they have to make employees redundant, or in the worst case scenario, if there's allegations of misconduct in the workplace. You know, that could be theft, fraud, you know, depending on where the person might work. So I suppose there are many different types of employment contracts that reflect the different types of working environments that we all live and operate in.
Yeah, and the reason, you know, kind of starting off asking that question is because some people would say, oh, well, if I'm on this type of contract, do I have rights when things may change in the coming months with winter and with the temperatures one works in? What would you say to anybody who's worried about that?
Well, I would say any of those contracts would be subject to the provisions under the Safety, Health and Welfare at Work legislation. And there is guidance that has been issued by the Health and Safety Authority around sort of temperatures, room temperatures within the workplace. So they, under the Health and Safety Authority guide to Safety, Health and Welfare at Work, General Application Regulations of 2007, they very clearly set out if you work in a sedentary office place, there has to be a minimum temperature of 17.5 degrees, so far as is reasonably practicable. And then the, you know, means should be provided as well to measure that temperature within any given workplace. Now,
Can I just ask you, what do they mean when they say the means be given to measure that temperature? Literally like a thermometer at the workplace?
Yeah, thermometer, some sort of way of accurately kind of measuring what the temperature is within that environment. But if you're sitting in an office all day, which many of us do, you know, that minimum temperature under the regulations should be 17.5 degrees. Interestingly, over the summer, there was a conversation around, is there a maximum temperature whereby you could be sent home from work? And the legislation doesn't currently have a provision that if it hits, say, 28 degrees or 30 degrees, that we should all be told to go home or go to the beach or whatever. but it does apply to that minimum temperature. But I think there will be challenges for employers and employees in their working environment, depending on the type of building that they operate in. There can be differences as well, depending on the nature of work. If you think, you know, particularly within the likes of maybe food production, laboratories, where rooms have to be kept at a certain cold temperature.
And then, Brenda, with COVID-19, obviously we had, you know, places like schools, they had to have all the windows open, you know, to keep circulation going. And so many other workplaces did the same to keep, you know, the people working there as safe as possible and tried to cut down the transmission of the disease, but obviously is still impactful on the employee and the staff.
Yeah. And that's going to be a huge challenge, I think, this year, especially because we're pretty much back to normal in terms of people being back in workplaces and not working from home as much. There are going to be challenges there, but the employer does have that duty under the Safety, Health and Welfare at Work, you know, to comply with those guidelines to ensure that there is a minimum temperature in place. What they may need to also provide, depending on the type of workplace, is they may need to provide additional measures. So it might be provision of certain specialist equipment or clothing, certainly for those individuals who work maybe in places where the temperatures have to be kept cold because of what they are actually working in or working around. Provision has to be, or care has to be taken as well for anyone who might be dealing with certain work where manual dexterity is important, so that they wouldn't be able to wear perhaps protective gloves because of the nature of maybe the type of work that they're involved in. And the employers would have a responsibility there to maybe provide, you know, an alternative heated room, you know, break rooms, maybe to rotate the length of time that a person's working in that cold environment to give them a break from that environment to ensure that they have the opportunity to, you know, to sort of to warm up and to have somewhere where they can have that break from that cold environment. Employees do have a responsibility as well in the workplace under the Safety, Health and Welfare at Work legislation. So it's not solely just the responsibility of the employer. So if you work in one of those environments where maybe the temperature is going to maybe be 16 degrees, say, for example, for food production, food hygiene purposes, that if you're provided with the protective clothing and equipment, you have a duty and a responsibility to actually wear that. And, you know, I'd argue as well, like coming into the winter months, maybe think about what we wear into work, You know, and how we actually dress, that, you know, that it's not just sort of the dressing suitably for work in terms of how you actually appear, but also what we might wear to keep ourselves warm, that we don't rock up to work in inappropriate clothing.
I don't think anybody, in fairness, is going to be rocking up in a pair of shorts and a bikini anytime soon, especially winter in this country. But we did have a good summer, but I think we've packed those items away. But thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. It was really lovely to speak with you, get some details on that. Of course, Dr. Brenda Daly is Associate Professor of Law at the School of Law and Government in DCU. That's on contracts there. And if you want any more information on that, she has written a piece on RTE Brainstorm. It's very interesting, going into the definitions of all the different type of contracts. And also, Brenda spoke about the Health and Safety Authority. That's the guide to the safety, health and welfare at work. The regulations for 2007. You can get those online at hsa.ie if you want any more details there. Just before I go, Teresa has texted in. Thank you so much for your text this afternoon. You're very kind, Teresa. I hope you are well. That text and WhatsApp line, as usual, for the whole station, 0833 97 97 97. And if you want to get in touch with Paul, who's on air from 3 o'clock now until 7, that is the line you can do so with. Does that make sense? Hopefully it does. See you later.